Welcome this morning. You picked a fine day to show up to talk about depression. I think the weather suits us today. This is what we're going to do this morning. I am Amy Moreno. I am what the LPCC stands for, is a licensed professional clinical counselor. I deal with depression a lot in my practice, as well as I've dealt with it a lot personally. So I kind of come to you today to share some things that have been helpful to clients, as well as what I know kind of personally, how to treat and manage depression. But how about we go ahead and pray and get things rolling? So I will just pray for us, and then we will dive into depression. Father, we do come to you, God. We just know that you care deeply about our feelings, about our thoughts, about the things that are going on in our lives. We thank you, God, that you know us so well, and you're so, and you desire an intimate relationship with us, that you want us to come to you with all of these things. And so help us, Father, to just draw near to you when we're struggling. And I pray this morning, Father, that I just know that you treat us with so much kindness and tenderness and mercy. And I pray that as we kind of dive into this topic today and look at this stuff, that you would just build some of that compassion in us for not only ourselves and what we struggle with, but for other people. We want to represent you accurately to people, God, and so we just ask that some of this material might be helpful in just representing you better to people. In your son's name, amen. Okay, so depression is something that's pretty predominant. It happens a lot. According to the CDC, there's 9% of adult Americans have feelings of hopelessness, despondency, or guilt that generate a diagnosis of depression. It is considered a worldwide epidemic that 5% of the global population suffers from this condition. Over the past two decades, the use of antidepressants has risen dramatically, that one in 10 Americans now takes an antidepressant. And among women in their 40s and 50s, this is one in four. So this is really on the increase. Depression most often strikes young adults, which I think is an interesting fact we should be well aware of. 10% of children suffer an episode before the age of 12. 20% of elderly report depressive symptoms. And again, this is also on the rise. We're finding more and more of it in nursing homes and retirement villages. 25% of all women have a depressive episode sometime in their life, and 11% of all men. Suicide is the 10th most common cause of death in America, and that comes directly from major depressive disorder. And suicide rate among adolescents has quadrupled in the last 25 years. So in addition to this, the research is also showing a higher correlation between technology and people and how much time they spend on technology and the increase in depression. So just to say, I think we're going to see the statistics going higher with our young people. So what does this mean to us? You know, is that we are going to encounter this, whether it's in our own lives, whether it's in people in our families or in our home groups, that one in 10 of us is going to suffer from some kind of serious depression. And you know, the bottom line is it's hard to know how to handle it. I don't know that we do a very good job at handling it with ourselves or with other people. I think we get impatient when people are depressed. I think we can judge and criticize people. I think people are unfairly disciplined when they're struggling with depression. I think that people can be told to do things that they're really not capable of doing. And I think that we often mistake depression for spiritual unwillingness, that someone's just not doing well, and it's a spiritual issue. And I think we also put unreasonable timelines on people. You know, this quote from Richard O'Connor from Undoing Depression, he says, "Too much of the public still views depression as a weakness or a character flaw and thinks that we should pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And all the hype about new antidepressant medications has only made things worse by suggesting that recovery is simply a matter of taking a pill." And this is often our first response when someone starts talking about depression is, "Have you been to the doctor? Maybe you need antidepressant." So I think that there's a lot of harm or a lot of things that can happen when we don't understand depression. So I think it's really important to spend some time thinking about this. What does depression look like? How can we be better at handling some of it in our own lives and in the lives of the people in our home groups? So let's just think through a couple scenarios here. And tell me what your thoughts are on this. So you've got a 19-year-old female who's moved into a ministry house. Her second year in, she starts sleeping through classes. She can't get out of bed. She withdraws from hanging out with people. She feels lethargic, and she watches TV shows a lot on her computer. So what would be your first impression? What would be your thoughts about what's going on with this young lady? Okay? So she might be suffering with depression. What is some of our kind of knee-jerk responses or our first impressions when we start seeing somebody that is sleeping a lot, they're not doing the stuff that they used to do? Apathy? That they're struggling with some apathy? Anything else? That they're lazy? Maybe she's avoiding some conflict, right? I think that our tendency a lot of times can be to think that there's something else going on, some kind of hidden sin, some kind of issue that they're not dealing with, right? Or maybe who did she sleep with, right? That there's some kind of stuff. But consider this. This is from the DSM. So the DSM is our Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's kind of the manual that we use in diagnosing and treating mental and emotional disorders. It said major depressive disorder may first appear at any age, but the likelihood of onset increases markedly with puberty. In the U.S., incidence appears to peak in the 20s. However, first onset in late life is not uncommon. So what does that mean? It means that we're going to be seeing this in our college ministry, right? Or in our young adult groups, that major depression can start to appear when people are in their 20s. So we got to be on the lookout for that. How about this scenario? A 25-year-old male, also living in a ministry house, gets depressed. He recognizes it, and others do also. He's encouraged to get treatment, so he goes to his doctor for some antidepressants, and he goes to counseling, right? Win-win. But a few months go by, and things don't seem to improve much. He's not engaging with people. He leaves early from home group. He seems to spend a lot of time on video games. And everyone starts feeling really antsy at this point because things are not changing. Is he just being stubborn? Is he not doing what he's supposed to do? Does he not want to get well? What might be your thoughts in encountering this? Yeah. So, and this is where we can start to kind of put some unreasonable timelines on people. But consider what the DSM says. Recovery typically begins within 3 months of onset for 2 in 5 individuals with major depression, and within 1 year for 4 in 5 individuals. So that means that it can take a while for someone to start to get better, right? But we often get very impatient in this process. You're taking medication, you're going to counseling. Why are things not getting better in your life? And yet, healing is a very individualistic process. And I think that we've got to figure out how to kind of slow it down and have more reasonable timelines on this. How about this scenario? A wife's husband just died. She's experiencing depressive feelings, loss of appetite, not sleeping well, struggling to get out of bed. Nothing is enjoyable anymore. What do you do? How do you help somebody that's struggling with it? It's going to be a lot like depression, right? What do you do? How do you help? What have you done? Yeah. Do a lot of crying. What else? Go be with them. Yeah, I think a lot of times we want to know how to help, right? Do we cheer them up? Do we try to distract them? Do we try to encourage them to start doing healthy things in their life? Do we let them isolate and kind of withdraw? What do we do? How do we help? Think about this, though. Grief is a lot like depression, but it is necessary for people to grieve their loss. It is an appropriate response. And the greater the loss a person has, the deeper the depression and the grief is going to be. And what they say about grief is grieve now, or grieve later, but you will grieve. It's a necessary process that we have to go through. But I think for a lot of us, a grieving person is really uncomfortable. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to help. We hate the fact that our friend is sad. We want to cheer them up. And so we start doing things. We start getting active and trying to do things that we're going to be helpful. Because oftentimes for us, it touches on our own fears. What if this happens to me, right? And it's a little too personal to watch somebody in the midst of grief. But I think, you know, people are complicated. Depression is complicated. Grief is complicated. And it is really hard to know how to help. But I think with all of us here, people that are committed to following Christ, people that want to serve and help and love people more effectively, that we need to learn how to do Galatians 6:2, where we bear one another's burdens better. Or Job 21:2, think about what his plea to his friends were. If you would just take some time to listen to me, to understand me, let that be the consolation that you give me, right? Just understand what I'm going through. Proverbs 18:2, a friend sticks closer than a brother. We know that this is true of Christ, but maybe this needs to be true of all of us too. And when someone is really struggling with some depression in their life, they need friendship. They need people to come alongside them. So let's kind of understand what depression looks like, what we're talking about. Major depression is the most serious kind of depression. This is the one that really interferes with your ability to work, to sleep, to study, to enjoy life. An episode can occur once in a person's lifetime, but more often than not, a person has several episodes of major depression. And the more, once you've started, had one episode of major depression, the likelihood of having follow-up episodes is very high. An episode is 2 weeks or longer, and it is strong depressive symptoms all day. And I want to underscore this point because I think we get confused about this. It means that you're not getting out of your depression all day. It's not the kind of person that wakes up in the morning, they feel a sense of depression, they go to work, and the mood lifts. This is the person that can't kick it. They can't get out of it. It's all day long for at least 2 weeks. It does impair your ability to function, whether it's occupationally or socially, academically, spiritually. It will affect your sleep and appetite and cognition and pleasure drives. It affects 1 in 6 Americans. There are medical problems that are associated with major depressive disorder. The distinction between major depressive disorder and other types of depression is typically, it's not always the case, but typically it is suicidal ideation. And it's the kind of suicidal ideation where you're just done. You just can't imagine going on. And so I know that we talk about this area of suicidal ideation quite a bit in a lot of different contexts, and thank God for that. But I just want to deviate a little bit and talk about it again, just to make sure that it's on your radar, that when someone is having suicidal ideation, we want to take these thoughts very seriously. Especially, and hear this very loud and clear, is if they have had prior attempts, if they know someone that has completed suicide, if they have ongoing thoughts, and if they have means to carry out their plan. With each one of these factors, it increases the likelihood of them making an attempt dramatically. And so this is the time when we really want to pay attention. Of course, we always want to pay attention, but we want to really hone in on it at this time. And so if you're in this kind of a scenario, the best thing to do is to take the person to an emergency room or to take them to some kind of hospital or neck care. What they will do there is they will give the person an evaluation so that you don't have to be the one to figure out how serious is this. They will take them in, they will evaluate them, and then they will either take them to a higher level of care or they will send them home with some kind of instructions. So it's important to do that. If you ever have questions or doubts, you're sitting in a situation, you don't know what to do, it's confusing, you don't have to email me. What you can do is you can call one of the suicide hotlines. Even if you're not the person that's struggling, it will help you know how to get help to this person that you're sitting with, or have them call and talk it through with this person on the hotline. They're going to be better able to evaluate what's going on and whether this person needs a higher level of care. If the person is having random thoughts, some suicidal ideation, but they haven't had prior attempts, they have no means to carry out their plan, it's just kind of one of these situations where I'm struggling, I don't know what to do, and sometimes I think, maybe it would be better if I wasn't here. Those kind of random types of thoughts, and they're not ongoing, they're kind of fleeting thoughts that pop into our minds. What we want to do is we really want to process them through with the person. What are you thinking? Tell me about it. What's been going on in your life? And we want to spend some time talking with this person about what's going on. And then we probably want to refer them to counseling, so that somebody else is getting their eyes on it and being able to evaluate what's going on. Major depressive disorder is really a big deal because it is the kind of disorder that will wipe out families. It takes people out of the workforce. Drug and alcohol abuse are rampant with major depressive disorder. And so when someone is struggling with that, it really is a big deal. Another disorder that is not as intense as major depressive disorder, but we still see quite a bit of it, is what used to be called dysthymia, but is now persistent depressive disorder. And this is the kind of disorder that lasts for at least 2 years. So it's that person that's kind of that low-lying depression that they just can't kick. They may have periods of major depressive disorder in the mix of it. But again, with persistent depressive disorder, it's somebody that's really been depressed for a long period of time, and they're just not able to get out of it. Then we have other kinds of depression that are a little bit different. We don't see them as often, but they're also important to be aware of because you will see them from time to time with people in your home group, or maybe you have suffered from them. Psychotic depression, which occurs when a person has had severe depression with some form of psychosis, such as having disturbing false beliefs or a break with reality, delusional, or they hear or see upsetting things that others can't hear or see, hallucinations. There's also postpartum depression, which is a little more serious than just kind of getting down and out after you have a baby. 10 to 15% of women experience this kind of depression after giving birth. And, you know, I think that we really need to be on the lookout for this, especially as we see the increase of people entering this stage of their life in our church. The American Medical Association says that 1 in 7 get affected with PPD, and this can last for many weeks or even months in a woman's life. And the other thing to note about this is that it can show up a few months after that they've had that they've delivered their baby, and this will affect the woman's ability to just get through the day, her daily functioning, as well as her ability to take care of that infant. And so it is really important to be on the lookout for that for the people in our home groups that are having babies. Seasonal affective disorder, we've been seeing a lot of that. I can just see I'm the clinical director at Wellspring Counseling, and you can just see the rise in numbers come about mid-October, and it just inflates because this is when we start to see it start, people start to call and say, I don't know what to do. I'm so depressed. I'm really struggling. This is characterized by the onset of depression during the winter months. What has been helpful for some is using light therapy, but it's kind of a toss-up. Some people find that very effective. Other people say it doesn't help at all. But it's something, again, to be aware of, that when this time of year hits, or, you know, kind of middle fall, oftentimes without the sun, people can get more depressed. It's a thing, right? We don't need to discount it. And then you've got bipolar disorder, which is a little more severe, where you have cycling mood changes. They can go from extreme highs to extreme lows, or it can be a little more like hypomania, where it's not so high or so low, but it's kind of a person that is cycling through mood changes. You've got adjustment disorder that can bring depressive symptoms. This is someone who has a transition, a change, and they're struggling with depression as a result of this. You know, anything from moving houses to losing your job, even a home church plant or split can bring on depression for some people. Somebody walking away from fellowship can bring on depression for some people. So it's important to be aware of that a lot of times people don't transition or they don't adjust to new things as easily as we think they should. And so for some people, a home church plant is a lot harder to get through than maybe what you would expect or what you would hope for them. There's also grief, and grief looks a lot like depression, but this is going to be tied to experiencing the death of a loved one. But we also experience grief and other types of loss. Maybe you've lost your pet. Maybe you've graduated college. Maybe you graduated high school and you don't know what to do. This can bring on depression. Maybe you've lost a friend. Your friend has walked away from fellowship, or you've split away from your good friend, and it's bringing on some depression. Not to mention things that are a little more serious, like divorce. That often will bring on a lot of depression for a person. Empty nest is another factor. So, you know, the bottom line is there's going to be a lot of grief in our lives, but we often don't recognize it as that. We just kind of think we should get through this. There's good reasons that we planted our home church. And so why can't I just get through this and process through this quicker? And we get really impatient with ourselves in the grief process, and we get really impatient with other people. We try to reason with them as to why this was important. And so get on board, quit having a bad attitude, you know, show up and start investing and serving other people. But we don't want to miss that grief is kind of important in our lives. You know, you think about Jesus at Lazarus' tomb. He took time to cry about it. Did he not know what was going to happen? You know, he lingered, took some time to get there. He shows up. He knows what's going to happen. He knows that he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead, right? But he wept. And I think that it just shows that it is important to grieve, that this world is not set up the way that it should have been. And so there is a grief process, but when we short-circuit that in our own lives, or we try to get others to short-circuit that process in their lives, then it ends up coming out sideways in people's lives. So it's okay to grieve. It's important to grieve. Okay, so, and then you've got spiritual depression. You know, and this can come when God seems far away, he's not listening to me, it feels like, you know, he's just abandoned his throne and left you kind of hopeless. And this state of mind, which a lot of us go through, even as we are actively following Christ, when you just feel like your prayers are not being answered or you're going through a long bout of suffering or difficulty in your life, it's easy to start experiencing some spiritual depression. You just don't have the energy like you used to show up, to serve, to love, to do all the things that you used to do so easily. Maybe not easily, but you were committed to them at any rate. And it's easy to just kind of give up under the weight of your feelings. When is it ever going to get better? I don't know. I don't know about this whole Christian life stuff. This is common stuff. And I think that, you know, as I go through these, the reason that I go through these is because it happens. It's almost normal. This kind of stuff happens to people. And it will happen in our own lives. So, what might you say, or how might you respond? This might be a little more rhetorical than I'm really looking for responses. But what would you do or say if someone said the following kinds of things to you? I can't quit crying. I feel so hopeless. Where is God? I used to believe in him. I used to be able to praise his name, and now I can't see him anymore. I feel so overwhelmed and confused and tormented, and I just don't know how to keep pressing on. I hate my life. I hate my life. I feel like God is sadistic, and he just keeps tormenting me. I can't do this anymore. I feel so overwhelmed that I'm having strong physical reactions to it. You know, probably our tendency in these situations is try to correct these things with truth, to try to address some of their misconceptions. No, God is not tormenting you. God is not sadistic, right? Let's open up the word and let's see the way that God truly is. We want to offer encouragement and hope and comfort, and all of that can be really good and really helpful. But sometimes it can also feel really condescending, right? Like you don't get it. You don't really understand. What if sometimes we just tell them, you're in good company? Because this was David, Psalm 42. I can't stop crying. I feel hopeless. Again in Psalm 42, where is God? He's abandoned me. I used to be able to do this, but where is he now? Or Paul, you know, I feel 2 Cor 4, I feel so overwhelmed. I don't know how to keep pressing on. Job, I hate my life. I hate it. And God is sadistic. He's tormenting me. And even Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane said, I am so overwhelmed. If there is any way that this cup can pass from me, please, Lord, please let it happen, right? To the point where he was having strong reactions. He was sweating drops of blood. It's pretty difficult. So how might you have counseled these people in the midst of their difficulty and their pain? Or what about some of these folks? These guys have also had strong depression in their lives. Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, what would you have said to Abe or Winston or Siggy? You know, Siggy, lay down on my couch. Let me tell you how to deal with your depression. In other words, maybe there's a caution here for us. That how we evaluate, how we interpret, how we land on things, how we counsel, might be a little black and white. And I just don't think that we're going to hurt anyone if we kind of slow the process down a little bit. If we take some time as someone is struggling to really prayerfully consider what's going to be helpful, to be a little more thoughtful in our counsel, in our direction. I think we get into trouble because we have a lot of knee-jerk reactions and we say a lot of things that are just stupid. And we need to slow it down a little bit, really think about it, be more careful, pray it through. So what depression looks like in a person's life, physically, they're tired, they don't have energy, it's hard to concentrate, they struggle with sleep, they either overeat or they don't eat enough, they got thoughts of suicide, aches and pains, it alters their activity levels, it's easy to get into procrastination, hard to get to things that they know they got to get to, lethargy, they feel just apathetic about life. Or sometimes you'll see with people that they overwork because this is the one thing that they can pour their energy and invest into and they see some kind of result from it. And so this might be the person that is working 60, 70 hours a week and they may be really struggling with some depression underneath all of it. It affects us cognitively. We have feelings of guilt, worthlessness, hopelessness. I feel so useless. I can't do anything. We can get irritable, restless. We can get into a lot of negative self-talk. I hate myself. I just can't do this anymore. We can be passive. It's just hard to keep showing up and investing and doing much, so we let other people kind of take the ball and run with it. We have selective attention. We can only focus on a few things, and it's usually the negative things that we focus on. We also get into really depressed logic. You know, I suck. Therefore, I shouldn't disciple anybody. I shouldn't follow up on anyone because I fundamentally suck, right? It affects us emotionally. We have sad, anxious, empty feelings, loss of interest in activities and hobbies that once we thought were pleasurable. We can isolate socially. We can get into dependency where we put someone else in charge of our life. You tell me what to do. I don't know what to do. You tell me what to do. We can also have counter-dependency, where we act as though we don't need anyone. We're not asking for input. We're not asking for feedback. Passive aggressiveness can be high with depression. Porous boundaries, where we allow others to over-affect us. You know, we get way too sensitive to what we think other people are thinking about us. We try to recruit accomplices, you know, people that will see it your way or don't expect much from you. It's kind of that principle in 1 Cor 15 about bad company corrupts good morals. It's going to affect us spiritually. We see a loss of zeal for our Christian lives. We can feel abandoned, alienated from God, disappointed, hopeless, apathetic. And it's just kind of a lack of desire for fellowship or instruction. You know, and these are not people that are just starting to come around and get invested into things. These can be people that have been walking with the Lord for 10, 15, 30 years. And you start to see some of this stuff. So, we've laid it out. It's a big thing. It's a thing. We're going to be interacting with this. But what is helpful? How do we engage people when they're struggling with some of this stuff? Well, what we know from research is that cognitive behavioral therapy is some of the best medicine for. And this is where you're really dealing with kind of how you're thinking and what kind of action steps are you taking in your life. Antidepressant has also proved very helpful for dealing with depression. Seasonal affective disorder, we already kind of talked about the light therapy. Other things that probably don't get as much attention but really need to be put out there is exercise. They've seen a strong correlation with somebody who starts to invest into an exercise routine that mood does lift. Healthy eating. There's been a lot of research done on that, that what we put into our bodies does really affect our mood. And then pleasurable activities is very big when it comes to depression. Oftentimes I tell people, you know, the first thing that we've got to do when you're struggling with depression is get some things back in your life that you enjoy doing, because it will help to bring up mood. So medications, you know, this is always kind of our first response when someone starts talking about depression, or can be our first response, is maybe you need to go to a psychiatrist, or maybe you need to go to a doctor and talk about getting on an antidepressant. Well, there's been some stuff said about antidepressants that I think is worthy of knowing. First of all, that it's not going to help, like Richard O'Connor says, if you don't change your life. Just taking a pill isn't going to change everything for us. I don't have this slide in your handouts. I added it later. But this guy is really interesting. He wrote a book called Saving Normal. Alan Francis, he worked on the DSM. I think he was editor-in-chief on the DSM-4. We now have the 5 out. But his view, so this is somebody, he's a psychiatrist. He's somebody that knows a lot and is very familiar with mental and emotional disorders. He says mental disorders should be diagnosed only when the presentation is clear-cut, severe, and clearly not going away on its own. The best way to deal with the everyday problems of living is to solve them directly, or to wait them out, not to medicalize them with a psychiatric diagnosis or treat them with a pill. Prematurely resorting to medication short-circuits the traditional pathways of restorative natural healing, seeking support from family, friends, and the community, making needed life changes, offloading excessive stress, pursuing hobbies and interest, exercise, rest, distraction, a change of pace. Overcoming problems on your own normalizes the situation, teaches new skills, and brings you closer to the people who are helpful. Medication is essential when needed to reestablish homeostasis for those who are suffering from real psychiatric disorder. Medication interferes with homeostasis for those who are suffering from the problems of everyday life. So you hear that? taking a pill isn't always going to be the best solution. Sometimes pressing into what's going on and being better problem solvers and knowing how to move at things in your everyday life is actually going to be the best medicine that you can get. So how do we know? How do we know what's what? What do we do? What do we recommend? How do we help? I think typically, this is what I've seen, what I've heard, and of course what I've done myself. These are our typical approaches. As we have kind of the same tool, whatever makes the most sense to you, this is what you recommend to everybody. So it's kind of, you know, if you're a hammer, everything is a nail principle. And so we kind of have the same things that we're always pulling out. You should read this book. You should join a gym. You should get medication. So, you know, whatever worked for the person that you talked to 30 minutes before, you might enter in and say the same thing to them, etc. Or we use our own experiences a lot. You know, what was so helpful for me is doing a gratitude journal. Or, you know, what really makes a big difference is when you get up, first thing in the morning, you get into the Word and you pray. And that'll change your whole day, right? And so we overpull on things that we think are going to be helpful. Or a lot of times we just do the, I don't know. I don't know what to say to you, dude. Maybe you should go get some counseling, right? And I think sometimes this is kind of a polite way to get rid of the problem. You know, I don't know what to do with you, so go call somebody else. And none of these are necessarily bad in of themselves, but I don't know that it really answers the question of what the person actually needs. I think it's your own way of looking at it. And so let me suggest some things on how we can maybe think about this a little bit differently. First of all, I think it's really important to understand the context of a person. And in order to understand the context of a person, we're going to have to avoid some things like black and white rigid categorizations. Things that we often think and say is all depression is bad. That's not necessarily true. Sometimes some depression can be helpful. I mean, you think about that list of all those people that we looked at. These people accomplished a lot in their life. They were given to a lot of thinking, to a lot of reflection, to a lot of understanding. And sometimes that is a little bit the way that depression can look. I think other black and white categorizations is that everybody needs X, Y, or Z, whether it's an antidepressant or whether it's counseling. And so we have this way of looking at things, but we're not really understanding the context of the person. And so in order to understand the context of the person, we want to understand what's normal for them. Not what's normal for you, but what is normal for them. And the only way we're going to understand that is if we take some time to listen to them, to pursue this, to ask some questions, to try to get a feel of what is a good day for you. Where do you find some relief? What has your history been like? Where have you struggled with this in the past? And what has been helpful to you in the past in dealing with it? Or is there an event that maybe has happened recently in this person's life that could be giving a lot of rise to depressive feelings? You know, maybe they just had a breakup. Maybe they just lost a job. Maybe they've had some conflict in their family. It may be even more minimal. In our view, it may be more minimal to things like, I gave a bad teaching, and I don't know how people are thinking about me. Or somebody just confronted me and I wasn't ready for it and it kind of set me off balance, right? These kinds of things, depending on the person, can really cause some depression. And so we're only going to know that if we take some time to kind of understand this person before us. And so in other words, I don't know that it's all going to happen in one conversation. Sometimes it's going to take a while to really kind of figure out what's going on with the person. Three things that we want to keep in mind when we're talking to people and they're telling us what their symptoms are and how they're struggling with depression. And I want you guys to keep these three words in your mind. It's severity. How severe are the symptoms, right? How intense are they feeling these symptoms? Duration. How long has this been going on? Because this matters a lot. If it's a day, probably not a big deal. If it's 2 weeks, a little more serious. If it's been a month and they're having a hard time kicking it, that's a lot more serious. And then frequency, how often are they having this? How often are they having these thoughts? What kind of things are popping into their mind and how frequently are they popping into their mind? Because this is going to help us understand a lot more accurately what's going on with the person when we can understand how severe the symptoms are, how long this has been going on, and how frequently this happens to a person. And we also want to figure out and help them kind of understand what works for them. You know, if exercise has worked for someone in the past, then let's kind of think through how we can get back to that. If maybe something is missing in their life that has been really valuable to them, like maybe they haven't been getting a good time with their family, or maybe they've split away from a relationship that has mattered a lot to them and they're not getting the support that they used to be able to get. Could we brainstorm some ways that maybe they could free up some time to get back to this stuff? Or I can't tell you how many people I've sat with in my office that they are just so overloaded with things in their life, so many commitments and responsibilities. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but what it's done is it's pushed out some of the things that they used to find a lot of pleasure in, some of their hobbies, some of their activities. And so they start sinking into depression. And I'm like, well, what if we just found a little bit of space that you could once a week, once every other week, get back to doing that thing that you really enjoy doing? And you know what? It works. They get happier again. And I think that we've got to be aware of that. There are things that we all need, lifestyles that can work, where we can do all the things that we do, and we can have good, stable mood in the midst of all of it. But it's not going to be the same thing for everybody. And so it's being able to identify what do you need, what works for you, and be willing to kind of think outside of the box. That's going to be most helpful for people. I think the other thing that people really need from us is this idea of empathy and support and encouragement. You know, people need a lot more encouragement and positivism than I think a lot of us tend to give. I don't know that we really do this enough for people. I think it's really easier for a lot of us. I think it's easier to get more negative and critical and always look at things as what's missing, what are they not doing right, where are they in sin, and start to address and confront these issues. Well, for a depressed person or somebody who is really struggling with a lot of hardship, it's just another brick on the wall, right? It's just another thing to weigh you down. So we have to feel like we can talk for a depressed person. They have to feel like they can talk about what's going on, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what is going on in their lives in a non-judgmental, safe, and caring environment. Are you that? Because we need to be that, right? We have to believe, in order for us to open up and to talk about the stuff that we're thinking and that's going on with us, which is ultimately going to be the best thing for someone who is struggling with depression is to be able to talk about the things that are going on with them. They have to believe that you care about it, and that it's an accepting environment, and that you're not just waiting to pounce on the first thing that they say and correct it with all the truth that you know and all the verses that will apply to this. And they also have to feel like they're not just a duty or a problem to solve, right? That you have not been sent into their life to now find out what's going on and address all of their issues. It really has to be a genuine thing. But I can't tell you how helpful this is to a person who is struggling with a lot of depressed kind of thinking or feeling. It's just the ability to sit with somebody else and talk about it. It's huge. But they're not going to talk if they feel like you're just waiting to correct them. So we also want to believe that this person, that this person is going to take the information that we're sharing with them and they're going to use it for my best interest. And so I'm not saying don't get help, don't get counsel, don't talk to other people about what's going on with this person, but they've got to believe that you're doing it for their good and not to just gossip or share or, talk negatively about this person. And I think that most people are, please, I need help. If someone else knows how to help me, that would be great. Let's get some input on this. I think we also want to be willing to share our own stuff when it comes to just depressive kind of thinking, negative thinking that we struggle with, hard feelings, that when another person is willing to share this, and I will grant you that I think all of you in this room have struggled with depression. And if you haven't, buckle up, it's going to come. Because this is almost a normal response to a lot of the things that go on in our lives. And so when we can share our stuff, it kind of normalizes it. And I think one of the things that we're all afraid of is that I'm going to be that whacked out, crazy person that nobody knows how to help or do or how to handle, and I'm going to turn out just like my mother or my father, right? We don't want that. But when we share our stuff, it does normalize it a lot more. We also don't want to overreact or underreact to what somebody's sharing with us. Underreacting would be hearing a word like depression or suicide and not investigating and saying, okay, cool, dude, what else is going on with you? Right? That's underreacting. When words are thrown out there, we need to take some time to investigate. What are we really talking about here? We don't want to overreact, though, by saying, the first time we hear somebody's talking about something, starting to really get on them about, okay, now you got to call a counselor or you got to go see your doctor about a depressant, antidepressant medication. You're starting the conversation. Sometimes it's going to be a lot more serious and you do have to take immediate action, but most of the times our conversations with people, we need to explore, we need to develop, we need to understand what are we talking about, what is the context that this is being shared in, and then we got to follow up in these conversations. So you were sharing last week about how you were struggling with such and such. How is that going? What's your thinking been like? How have you been feeling? What have you been trying to do to counteract that stuff? Right? These are conversations that we can and we should really be having with one another, is investing into each other's emotional life and how are they really doing. So some helpful things, some direction that we can give people as they are sharing with us, some things that we know, all of this stuff has empirically supported data to say that this stuff matters. It changes depression. Physically, getting people to think about structure or routine in their lives. A lot of times we get depressed because we just don't have a good lifestyle, right? We're not getting enough sleep, or we're not eating meals that are helpful on a regular basis. And so mood will go down when we kind of don't take care of ourselves physically. And so talking with people about, hey, how much sleep are you really getting? When are you going to bed, and when are you getting up, and what's happening throughout the day? Because if you're staying up till 4 in the morning and sleep until 3 in the afternoon, I grant you that at some point in there, you're probably going to get depressed. So structure is really key. Eating, we've talked about. Exercise, we've talked about. Also, activity. Just getting out and about. It's not going to be helpful if somebody just sits on the couch and keeps playing video games to think that their depression is going to ease. But when you can just get out, and this can be minor activities, you know, just whether it's going for a walk or whether it's going to the store to pick up some groceries or whatever it is, there's something about getting your body moving and interacting with other people in normal ways that helps to lift our mood. It's okay to ask people about this area of their life. You know, how are you doing with structure? What is it going? How's it going day to day for you? Are you getting out and about? Mentally, we've already kind of talked about this, but this idea that we really need to share our thinking, we need to share our thoughts. You know, when we talk about stuff, it gives us more perspective as to what's going on. When you sit and you stew and you spin in your own thoughts, they don't necessarily self-correct. Right? Have you ever noticed that? That you don't seem to be able to process and problem solve and figure things out when you're just spinning in something negative. But when you sit down and you start talking it through with a good, safe, trusted friend, all of a sudden it's like you get a little more insight, you get a little more light, things seem to shift a little bit more. And honestly, I think that this is the biggest thing that happens in the counseling process, is that people are talking about what's going on. And it's not that these counselors are like so amazing and have so much wisdom. It's that they're hearing themselves talk about what's going on, and they're almost problem solving their own issues, because we need that. You're not going to get better the more you sit and isolate and think about all your problems. It's not going to happen. Probably. We need to challenge our thinking. We need to work on changing our thinking. I think that this can happen not only as we're talking about what's going on with us, but we also need perspective. And so it does come in the form of reading books or listening to teachings or sharing our stuff with other people. That this is what helps give us perspective. And so we want to be able to check in with people. How are you doing? What kinds of things are you doing and investing in to kind of get some perspective on what's going on with you? Tell me about that book that you're reading. Tell me what you heard from that teaching the other day, because our thoughts can be really dark and really negative. Emotionally, we want to make room for fun and laughter. You know, this is a big part. Distraction can be helpful when somebody's in the midst of hard depression or grief. Just being able to have time where we're not talking about serious stuff, where we can just kind of play and have fun. I love this research that Henry Cloud, if any of you know me, I'm a real fan of Henry Cloud. But he talks about, in one of his YouTube videos, he talks about research that they did on monkeys. And He says, you know, they were testing the stress, the cortisol levels of monkeys. And so they would throw a monkey in a cage, and they would do all these wacky things to this poor little monkey. You know, they would shake the cage, they would do these flashing lights, these loud noises. Then they'd pull this poor thing out of the cage, and they'd test the cortisol levels, and it was always high. And so then they'd throw the monkey back in the cage, and they would change up what they would do. Maybe they wouldn't do flashing lights, or maybe they would do less intense sounds or whatever. And they'd pull the monkey out, they'd test the cortisol levels, levels still high. So the only thing that they found that made a difference is by throwing another monkey in the cage. That when they did that, they could do all the same things, even worse things. They could shake the cage, louder light or louder music and more intense lights, and they'd pull the monkey out, cortisol levels were down. And so the implication, what this means to us, is that we all got to have a monkey. That we can endure a lot more. We can go through hard things and difficult things and stressful things and depression if we feel like somebody's in it with us. If someone else is sharing the pain with us, it makes it not so bad. And so we do all need a monkey, but we also need to be a monkey for somebody else. And so who's in it with you? Who do you feel like shares it to the degree that you do? So we want to be able to kind of have this, to be able to process. If we don't do this, if we're not sharing, if we're not processing what's going on with us, if we don't feel like we've got people in it with us, then what happens is that we tend to stuff it and we push it all down. And then it will come out sideways or it doesn't come out at all. And then somebody, you know, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, they're kind of a wreck. And it takes a lot of work to kind of get back to what has really been going on with them. Relationally, when somebody's depressed, this is really important, is that we don't want them to isolate. We don't want them to give up on their time with people. I think a strong tendency when someone's depressed is to want to isolate, to get away from it all. It all just feels too much pressure, too demanding. And yet we find that the more people isolate, the worse the depression gets. But when somebody can continue to do some of the things that they normally do, you know, get together with somebody, show up to home church, come to CT, whatever kind of social, relational things that they have been doing, and the expectations, we just give them freedom to, you know, just come. You don't have to carry on a conversation. You don't have to input a lot into the meeting. You don't even have to talk about a lot of the stuff that's going on with you, but just be there. That presence of being around other people does help. And so we want to get concerned if we see a person isolating a lot. It's good to keep encouraging them to come on out, but lower the expectations. We're not expecting you to show up and to teach home church tonight. Just come and be with us. And spiritually, you know, again, we don't want to give up on some of the things that are really good and healthy, even when we're struggling and we feel lethargic and apathetic. Pressing into it, pressing into your time with the Lord, pressing into continuing to pray and being honest with God. You know what? We think we're going to deceive him about what's really going on with us. He knows. He's got it. He just wants you to kind of come and keep talking to him about it. That this really is helpful, is that when we commit to keep showing up and talking to God about what's really going on with us, it does impact our mood. It does help with our depression. And so I think coming alongside people and just caring about this area, you don't have to expect a lot from them. A lot of times it's good to just say, hey, can I share this passage I was reading today? Would you like to hear that? Or can I pray over you? That is wonderful. Sometimes we don't have it in us to be able to pray, but when someone comes along and just says, let me pray over you, that's super helpful. So these are some of the things that I think are really, well, we know these things are really helpful. And I think that these are some of the ways that we want to kind of come alongside other people that are going to be helpful in the midst of their depression, or things, if you're struggling with depression, that you want to keep your mind on this stuff. You know, am I keeping some good structure to my life? Am I sharing my thoughts? Am I processing what's going on with me? Am I staying connected with people? Because what we see with depression is it will ease up over time, but it's not going to necessarily ease up without any kind of intervention into it. Okay? So these are some healthy interventions that will make a difference. So how do you know if a person needs counseling? When should you refer someone to counseling? When is it a little more serious than you know what to do? And I think these are a few things to think about, is when things are not getting better for a person. They just seem to keep struggling. They're saying the same things. You've engaged with them on how they're doing in some of these areas of their life, and they're not able to do much of anything. I think that's definitely a place where you want to refer them. When you don't know what to do, sometimes maybe you've exhausted your resources and you really don't know how to be helpful anymore. That's fine. Definitely refer them. When there's suicidal ideation going on, just because the risk of this is so much higher, that we want to really refer them when they've got this going on. So who would you refer them to? It doesn't all have to be clinical counseling. I think pastoral counseling is really helpful, can be really beneficial for somebody that's struggling with some spiritual depression. They've got some relationship issues that are going on, or home church struggles, or even if there's depression around an event. And you just kind of need some help knowing how to manage this transition in your life, or this breakup, or what do I do about school that I just failed out of. I think that this kind of stuff, when you can tie it to a specific event, I think pastoral counseling can be super helpful. I think you want to think about clinical counseling when the symptoms are more than just an event, or you're seeing it in more than one area. It's not just this breakup, but I'm struggling with school and I'm struggling with all this other stuff too. When it's affecting more than one area of their life, then I think we're looking more at a diagnosis of some kind of depression going on. And so let me just put on your radar some books that I found helpful. I really like Ed Welch's book, The Stubborn Darkness, Undoing Depression by Richard O'Connor. He is not a believer that I know of, but I think he's got some really good things to say. David Burns, this has been a book that's been used tremendously over the years. Telling Yourself the Truth, that's really helpful to read every now and again. And then, of course, The Spiritual Depression by Lloyd-Jones can be very helpful. So that's all I have about depression. Is there questions or thoughts or things? Yeah. Yep. I think, one, we want to help them to the largest degree that we can and offer to go with them. You know what I mean? How about you just come with me? You just sit with me tonight. You know, we'll just, no pressure, no expectations. I think also kind of reminding them that things are probably not going to get any better. They're not going to feel any better the longer that they play their video game or isolate in their room is helpful. To just remind them that I get it. I get that it's hard. I know there. I've been there some myself. But what's probably going to be more helpful to you tonight is if you just come with me. Let's just go. And even if we just stay for an hour, it'll be better than not going at all. Well, I think that's going to fall in the category of something that somebody needs to talk about. You know what I mean? And so it's how are we setting it up with that person that they feel like they can tell us what has really been going on and probably at the root of some of their mood disorder right now. And so that, you know, that can be just all over the place, that sometimes they just need the atmosphere that they feel like they can say it, and you're going to work with them to what does restoration look like. Sometimes they're just going to be resistant because they really don't want to give up their sin, and there's not a lot you can do about that. But yes, if you feel like there is something underneath the depression and it's cited to more of an event that is driving the depression, then we got to identify what that event is, even if it's some kind of sin. So the question is, how do you discern when sharing your own stuff, your own experiences, your own story and all of it is going to be helpful, or when may it feel like it's a little condescending, that you're just trying to put on somebody else what your experience is, right? Is that accurate? And I think, you know, we are prompted to share our stuff after we've really understood and listened well to somebody else. I think that often you see with people that they'll jump right in, you know, it's like you're triggered or you have a quick reaction. Somebody says something and it's like, oh yeah, I totally can relate to that. And then you kind of go off, you know, and you're gone. And that's just not helpful to the other person. By the time someone starts kind of opening up and starting to tell you things, that's where you need to settle yourself down and really start to listen and to engage with them. And then typically after they have talked for quite a while, they're looking for something from you. And that is the time where maybe you kind of share your own experience or you give them something that was helpful to you or you recommend something that you have heard. But what I have discovered and found and my informal research that I've been doing over years is that usually we're too quick to respond when someone starts sharing. And I think if we just slow that process down a little bit and we really kind of let a person just talk for a while, you're going to have a lot more insight as to what's the next step.
Most people's knee-jerk reactions mm-hmm. are not that helpful. Do you think that's stems from like human nature, or do you think it's training that we've had, or do you think it's a false ethos among home church leaders? Like, what do you think it stems from? And then, I mean, maybe this is loaded, but like, how do you think we change that culture, I guess?
Yeah, one of I think it's a lot of different things, and it's probably a very layered kind of question. But one of the things that I heard that came out of our own ranks that I, of course, I find very disturbing, and I hope you will join me in that, is that someone was quoted as saying a depressed person is not a Christian at all. And you know, it's kind of trying to link two things together, that if we are struggling with some kind of mood disorder or some kind of hardship or difficulty in our life, that obviously that's not following Christ. And so I think that we come to situations with our own baggage, with our own viewpoints, with our own evaluations, and we don't check them very often. And so I think that there is stuff that is communicated to people that comes out of our own baggage, maybe some out of our own training, I don't know. But I think that more than not, I think where it comes from is that we are problem fixers. And so when somebody presents a problem to me, then you're asking me to fix your problem, right? And that's not really why people are presenting things to us. And I think that being able to step outside of it and figure out how to listen and understand the context and hear a person is going to help them be able to solve their problem more effectively than you being the problem solver in everybody's lives.
And so we've encouraged and referred people to go to outside counseling. And in both scenarios, there's been a resistance to counseling. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how can we as, you know, friends, leaders, encourage counseling and kind of stand up for counseling when there's resistance without it becoming a law and without it becoming the thing that we're now fighting over,
right.
And the issues are kind of falling off, which is what the counseling is for in the first place.
Right. Yeah, this can be a really tricky situation because, and it just depending on the severity of what's going on. On the one hand, I would say that if we kind of have an approach with people of, I hear what you're saying and I see what you're struggling with and it's been going on, you know, again, we're looking at the severity of the symptoms, the duration and the frequency, and we can kind of feed that all back to a person and then ask them, what do you think would be a good step for you to do? This is kind of the picture that I'm seeing. What do you think is going to be helpful? Because if a person can identify for themselves what they think is going to be helpful, they're going to be a lot more motivated to do it and to follow through with it. That oftentimes, I think in our interactions with one another, we tell each other what to do rather than helping people figure out what do you think you need to do that's going to be helpful. And just turning that dynamic a little bit is going to change the whole dynamic of the issue and the relationship that you have. However, the caveat to that is that sometimes things are so serious that we can't kind of, and they may be really stuck in their issue, and the idea of counseling or outside help just sounds horrific to them, and they may never be motivated, even if they came up with that solution on their own. And so what do you do in a situation like that? And I think you do, for their own sake and for their own safety, I think sometimes we do have to push hard at it. You know, and I think we can present it in the way of, I'm not qualified to be able to handle what's going on with you. And it is having an impact on the people around you. And so you really do need help. And we need to get you to a place where it's going to be helpful. Here are some resources. Here are some options for help. And I think, you know, giving some people some choices and where and how to get help is going to be better for them than us telling them, you have to go see this particular counselor, or you have to go to this particular agency, or whatever it is. That we need to feel a little bit in control of what's going on with us. And so I think it's being able to give a person feedback of how serious we think that this issue is, but giving them some arena to make some of their own decisions about it.
Two questions. My first one is, do you know of a resource where people give their own story about being depressed and getting through it? That's one of mine, where there's a compilation of stories. Especially maybe from believers. And then my second question is, as a counselor, are there certain attitudes or behaviors? Is there something you see in, as you look through a variety of depressed clients, people, are there certain things that you're like, uh-oh, they've got that thing that means they might not get through their depression? Are there certain warning signs that someone's in a way of thinking or a behavior or self-talk or something like that, that it's like, oh no, this person might not get out.
Yeah.
And can we know what those are?
Yeah. Okay, good. As far as some particular resource that would give a lot of people stories, I can't think of one. In all of these books, they're going to have elements of people kind of sharing their own stuff or examples of that. But I can't think of one particular book that would be just kind of people's own personal stories. When it comes to kind of patterns or dynamics that we see where we get pretty concerned, and I probably should have mentioned this already, is that when somebody is unwilling to try anything different in their life, that's not usually a good sign. You know, that when you hit those areas, cognitive, emotional, social, physical, and spiritual, we need to see people at least trying to make some steps in those directions. But when they just stop and they're just unwilling to do anything different, you know, it's kind of like a ship. You can't move a ship that's just dead in the water. If it's got a little momentum, it's much easier to direct. And so we know that all of those things are going to be healthy and important for anybody that's struggling, whether it's depression or whatever kind of mood disorder or whatever kind of grief or whatever's going on in your life. Being able to concentrate on those areas and make some steps in it is going to be the best scenario. Yeah, and I don't want us to not give people feedback. When I say listening and understanding, I'm saying give it some time to really understand the context of a person and to be asking questions. But yes, there will come a point in time if somebody is not kind of making some movement on their own that we do have to give feedback. You know, kind of like in this scenario that we were talking about of, you know, I've seen you wrestling with these thoughts for quite a long time, and I'm not hearing what you're doing to try to combat them at all. Or you keep saying that that you know that investing into the Word, into prayer, and into your relationship with Christ again is important, but I'm not seeing you take any action steps with that. What is it that you think is going to be helpful for you to be able to do that? And so I think we do want to draw people's attention to the fact that these are important things, and if you're getting kind of stuck, maybe it's because you're not trying to do anything different. So I think the key thing in all of this is that we want to be engaging the conversations with people, and it's not necessarily just always referring them out for counseling, but it's like, can I create the kind of atmosphere in the relationship with someone that I can talk about how are you doing in these areas of your life? And are you trying and doing some things a little bit different? I think that that's the role that we can play. Yeah, trauma is a little bit different than depression. And so so it's probably kind of a whole different game plan that we're talking about and dealing with people that, because what you're dealing with is not only people that have been affected by trauma, but they're still oftentimes in the midst of traumatic situations. And so their coping mechanisms are going to be fight or flight because it's survival right now. And they're not going to probably be in a place in their life where they can start to process and understand some of the things that have happened to them or are currently happening until they're in a safer place in their life. And so that's some of the stuff that we see working with at-risk youth and others. So, sorry, Fritz, you came to the wrong one. Yeah.
I'm asking a question, changing from the focus for the person who is depressed to the person who's the listener. Mm-hmm. And where do you see the resistance on the part of the listeners to actually engage in the listening? Or where do you see the fault line on the part of the counselor person in this process?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know where I make my big mistakes is when I try to interject too soon. And I try to, or give some kind of concrete thing that I think is going to be helpful too soon. Is that's usually where I get most of the kickback, is that somebody just wasn't ready, or they hadn't felt heard, or they hadn't felt understood. And so what I keep reminding myself of, you know, day after day as I walk into the office is I got to slow it down. I got to be there. I got to understand. I got to really see it from their perspective. And it's just can be hard work because it takes a lot of us pulling back and resisting some of the things that we think, you know, that are going to be so wise, or our own perspectives or whatever it is. And so we hit listening a lot. And I think probably we all think that we're pretty good listeners by this point. You know, you've worked with a lot of people, you've sat with a lot of people, you've heard a lot of stories. But honestly, really good listening and understanding is hard work and takes a lot of time and takes a lot of maturity. And I tell you, I think I'm probably, you know, I got a long way to go, is what I'm saying. So I just think it's in that if we want to focus on how can I really sit with people and listen to them and to understand them and to not get in the way of what God is probably wanting to do in the midst of this interaction, it's going to be quieting ourselves down so that we can really hear a person.
One of the cool things about what you're saying about listening is that, like you're saying, we feel this urge to interject, like, oh, here's this blaring issue, and if I don't say something about it, then it's not going to be dealt with. But I think the more work that we put in with listening and asking questions, and the less that we are just so quick to give advice, yeah. I think I'm often surprised that people already are having convictions and thoughts about that issue, and the more that we ask questions, like you said, they're coming up with, maybe here's this thing that I need to do, and then you haven't really said very much at all or given very much input. They've come to that conclusion on their own, and then, like you said, in the future, you can hold them to, like, you had this conviction to do this mm-hmm. thing. I'm not the one that, you know, told you to do that or pushed you to go to counseling. You felt like you needed help, and so then I feel like it's much more you're understanding them, coming alongside what God is already doing in their heart, and, you know, taking more of a supportive role, and, you know, they feel that support much more.
Good. Well said. Thank you.
So do you have any insight in how to draw out a person who, to talk about maybe their depression, but if their reaction to that is maybe one of anger or resistance?
So how to, if somebody is demonstrating a lot of anger, but you kind of know that this is probably a feature of depression, how do you kind of work with that and draw that out? Is that your question? Yeah, definitely anger. Depression can manifest in a lot of anger and a lot of, just aggressiveness in life. And I think it's going to be the same thing. You deal with an angry person the same way that you deal with a depressed person, is that you want to understand. The minute you sit down and start talking to somebody who is struggling with anger and just seeking to understand what's going on with you in a calm way, their anger starts to come down. And so it's just like, you know, help me understand what's going on with you. I hear you saying some things. I see that you're upset about some things, but I really want to hear what you're thinking, what you're feeling, how this is affecting you. I can see that these situations have upset you a lot, and I'd probably be right there with you. But help me understand it from your point of view, from your context. I want to know what really bothers you about this situation. And so as we can kind of approach that, they come down, and then you're going to get a lot more wisdom and insight into what is driving the anger for them.
How about when you're talking with an unbeliever? You know, they need the gospel, but people with the gospel are also depressed. So how do you wade through those?
Yeah, I think depression is something that's going to happen, obviously, to both Christians and non-Christians. And that's kind of a normal thing. And depression is going to be a normal response to a lot of different things in life. And so I don't know that it's any different that you talk to a non-Christian versus a Christian. I think it's going to be the same thing. You want to see how are they connecting the dots in their life? What are they thinking? What do they feel like has been missing in their lives? Or what do they feel like is really difficult to deal with? And what's bringing on this depression for them? And so that it can be an excellent opportunity, not that the gospel has changed everything in my life and that my mood, now I'm a completely happy person, and that's not what the gospel promises, right? But it does promise that Christ is going to come and he's going to be with you in the midst of all of it, and it is going to make it a lot more bearable to do your life, right?
Encountered in one of our girls' ministry houses is a roommate who struggles or like has had a long-term struggle with depression and then sleeping through classes, failing classes, not making it to her job, not having rent to pay. And the girls in the ministry house are doing these things like trying to help her wake up, trying to help her make it to her discipleship time, and then her roommates now are starting to get resentful. Like, we're trying to wake you up every single day. We're trying to make sure you make it to all your hangouts. You actually come to home church and whatever, and you actually eat and don't just drink pop. And they've almost come onto this, like, now we have to be in charge of her and stuff. And I kind of thought, like, you know, you guys can't be responsible for her. And that was kind of my mentality, was like, you guys need to allow her to choose to, like, listen to this, and you can't take responsibility for her choosing to, like, not kind of like accept the help or like take some steps on her own. Right. And right. I was kind of wondering if that was the right perspective, or how I could encourage like her roommates to be supportive, but also not take her on as their full responsibility.
Right. Yes. And this can be a very difficult situation, because I think, you know, this is one of the ways that we want to help is, oh, you have a need, I can help you meet that need. I can get you up in the morning. I can provide 3 meals a day for you. I can tell you when to go to bed. But that doesn't set it up well for another person, especially for an adult. Maybe there's a time for that when we're children and we got to have somebody telling us what to do. But usually and hopefully the people that are living in ministry houses have passed that point, right? And they are now adults in their life. And so taking over responsibility for somebody else to do things for them that they should be able to do for themselves is not going to be helpful. It's just creating a very codependent kind of relationship. What she needs, what this person needs, is to be able to take some ownership and responsibility for her life. And so it's being able to say, okay, here are some issues. These are some things that are getting in the way of you living in the house. And so how are we going to problem solve this? You know, what are some things that you're willing to do differently? And, you know, help her kind of think it through. Maybe it's setting up 5 alarm clocks, you know, throughout the house that she's getting up and getting out of bed. And seriously, I've had to do this with a number of people. She somehow has to figure out how to make life happen for herself. That it's not going to be helpful if other people are doing it for her. It just creates a more dependent relationship. And so, yeah, you're right on the money, and being able to kind of draw some lines there and helping the girls know what's going to ultimately be helpful for her. Gosh, you guys have so many questions. Wow.
I'm curious if you think that do we use depression as an emotion? Like, we should be using sadness? I was kind of just Googling, like, what's the difference? And, you know, sadness is normal. We can kind of snap out of it. But depression is, you know, everything that you've been talking about. And I feel like I've heard, like, Bev talk about, you know, we need to get used to feeling down. It's part of life, like, right. And that kind of thing. So it's just, I mean, do we need to be careful with our language? And how do you see that being helpful?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at depression, it's going to be a depressed feeling that doesn't go away. You know what I mean? It's kind of that serious, depressed feeling or sad feeling that you just can't shake. It doesn't go away. But having normal levels of sadness matches life a lot of times, right? It would be really weird to go through something difficult in your life and have no sense of sadness. Can it creep into depression? Yes. Can there be moments that you feel really more sad and maybe more depressed in the midst of a difficult struggle? Absolutely. I don't, you know, semantics, I'm not sure that I'm going to pick it apart, but I'm going to be looking for those three things. When I start hearing someone talk about some of the symptoms that they're struggling with, because that's where we're going to really define the difference between is someone struggling with depression now versus maybe just kind of a normal response to somebody walking away from the Lord or something like that.
I know you were talking just a moment ago about helping that person in the ministry house kind of take ownership for their own actions. I was just thinking, in normal situations, we often use painting a negative vision or helping people kind of own the consequences of their actions as a way to help them move forward, kind of at the risk of, you know, making them feel bad. And I guess I was just wondering, what kind of role do you think that plays when someone's struggling specifically with depression? Is there something we should be wary of when kind of like painting that negative vision, or is that still a helpful tool, or just what do you think that would look like?
I think it just depends so much on what the context of what's going on. I mean, I think that we can get into situations in the ministry house where someone is having really negative and bad behavior that is affecting the house and dragging it down, and that person isn't taking responsibility for their behavior and they're not making changes. And because we've kind of agreed on some things to all live together in this house, it has to be addressed. It has to be confronted, because it's not just this other roommate situation, right? There's kind of this agreement that we've all decided together and how we're going to live in this context. But at the same time, in saying that, you know, that situations do have to be addressed, and sometimes painting consequences, like if you can't pay your rent or if you keep being late for rent, that may really put the ministry house on the line for you. I think the caveat to that is that I think we tend to overdo it on painting negative consequences, and there's not a lot of positivism. You know, people need more vision and they need more encouragement in what can my life look like if I can really deal with this, or what are some positive things that I can do that are going to be helpful. And so I think our knee-jerk reaction is to really clamp down and be pretty tough and strict with some people that really need more encouragement than they do. So I think if you have exhausted your encouragement, like if you have spent quite a bit of time trying to paint vision and be positive and encouraging and empathetic and supportive, and that person is not making any changes in movement, then yes, it's time for that conversation of what might be on the line if you're not willing to take this seriously. So, okay, I vote one last one, and then we're good.
I was curious how, you know, because we're in a spiritual warfare, so how does the evil one play into some of this? Because, you know, sometimes I get the sense like some of these thoughts that are coming in are definitely from the enemy.
Yeah.
And when do you...
Yes.
You know, you don't want to always say, oh, it's Satan. No, it's Satan.
Right.
But then it's like there's a reality to that.
Right.
So
right.
Do you have any input on that one?
And I think that this is why we want to create safe environments to share the things that we're thinking. Because, you know, how many thoughts get planted in our brains that are just directly from the evil one? And as people don't talk about stuff and they don't share what's going on with them, it just tends to take more and more root into our lives, and then we start acting out in behaviors like getting alienated and isolating and that kind of stuff. And so the more that we can kind of create atmospheres where we can hear what each other is thinking so that we can identify this may really be an attack of the evil one is going to be helpful. I think that we all have a propensity, obviously, towards wickedness and to evil, and it doesn't necessarily take the enemy to put things into our brains. And so sometimes we can overdo it. But what I have seen with people is that sometimes they just get hit with a lot at one point in their life, and it just feels like you can hardly get your head above water before another kind of hard thing or an attack hits. And I think that it's that relentless kind of attack, that relentless part of the evil one, that can really wear a person down. I know that I have seen it in my own life when I just felt like I could barely hang on and it just didn't stop. And so at that point, I knew that it was probably a lot bigger than just my own little wickedness. I mean, my own wickedness is pretty bad, but sometimes you really are under assault from the enemy. And, you know, there's only one way through that, and that's going to be the prayer of your friends and the people around you, because there's only one way to attack that kind of assault. So I think, yes, we can overdo it on attributing a lot to the enemy, but on the other hand, it is real, and he is after us, and he will try to take us out in any kind of way